The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Speaking about the parsha of Shlach, the portion of the spies, and if it's the case that these men were men of stature, that the word Ish, the word Anashim, always means men of significance, then these were the leaders of the Jewish people. And that seems to be pshat. That seems to be the context. These spies, here in the portion of Shlach, were absolutely the leadership of the Jewish people. And this is a generation that witnessed the most incredible period of time the Jewish people have ever undergone. I mean, they saw the splitting of the sea. They saw the 10 plagues. They heard God speak to them at Sinai. This generation, and the leaders of this generation, doubted that Hashem could enable them to conquer the land. That they had questions about whether, if Hashem, and by the way, never mind whether God could conquer the land. If God says that this is the place to be, then what's the difference what you think of it? Well, who cares what your perspective is? If this is where Hashem wants me to be, then this is where I need to be. It's interesting that that in the portion of the spies, one of the pivotal lines of the Meraglim, right, is Vanihi beinenu kechagavim, right? We were in our eyes as grasshoppers, v'chenayinu beinehem, and so we were in the eyes of these giants that lived in the land. So Soloveitchik is quoted as having said, this is actually a line that Rabbi Avi Weiss loves to quote, right? If you think you're a grasshopper, then you're a grasshopper. As soon as you think you look like a grasshopper, then you become a grasshopper, right? How you perceive yourself, your image of yourself, is very significant. If you think you're short, then you're short. You know, when I was a kid, until I think 11th grade, I was 5'1½". Then I had my growth spurt. But I never really realized that I was short, because my parents never told me that I was short. My brothers never told me that I was short, because they were also short. And so I never thought of myself as short. In fact, it took until I was 10 years old to realize that I wasn't going to make it to the NBA. Right? I mean, how you view yourself has a lot to do with who you become. So the spies wanted to see the land through eyes other than Hashem's eyes. So they saw the land through their own eyes. They saw the land through the Canaanites' eyes. But they were missing the right perspective and how to look at things. And that's very difficult to understand. How could this generation doubt that Hashem could bring them in? That's the first question. How could such a leadership have questions, have issues with the fact that God would enable them to conquer the land? Then you get to question number two. If already the spies are coming back, and they're suggesting that there's a problem, and they're doubting that this is going to work, Efes ki azam, the people are strong, and they sit in fortified cities, and it's an eretz ochelet yoshveh, it's a land that consumes its inhabitants. Now, granted that, according to the Medrash that Rashi quotes, Hashem sends a pestilence in the land so that people, the Canaanites, will be busy burying their dead and they won't notice the spies. But the spies view this as sort of, you know, a besmirching of the land, that it's negative, that there's illness in the land, and that, of course, speaks to the fact that how you look at things, your perception of the world, the only freedom of choice we really have in this world is how we choose to look at the world, right? But okay, so they come back with this negative perspective. So, where are Moshe and Aaron? Do you know what the pasuk says? It's an unbelievable pasuk. The verse says, "Vayiplu al pneihem." They fall to the ground. They're speechless. They're overcome by the fact that these spies could come back with a negative report, and that the people would listen to them, and the people start to murmur and start to complain. Right? I mean, we're talking about a few months after they left Egypt, or a few months after Sinai. According to Jewish tradition, "Vayivku balayla," who they cry on that night. So God says, "Atem bechitem bechiyah shel chinam, you cried for nothing. Eten lechem bechiyah shel mamash, I'll give you something to cry about." That night is the ninth of Av. That becomes the night that we have cried over for generations. So it's Av. It's August. They got out of Egypt in April. I mean, they just saw everything. And Moshe has led them through. So Moshe should stand up and say, "What's the matter with you people?" Now, we know that Moshe is not normally at a loss for words. He has no problem. Shimuna Hamorim, he says, "You rebels." He rips Korach to shreds. when Korach rebels in a few weeks. So where are Moshe and Aaron? Why do they have nothing to say? And maybe the third question, which is most fascinating of all, is what happens when Yoshua and Kalev, first of all, Yoshua, who clearly does not agree with the other 10 spies, nonetheless says nothing. You don't see him. But Kalev steps up to the plate. Kalev attempts to become that Hish. Vayas Kalev et Am, and Kalev just quietens the people. You know, you can almost imagine that there's a big hullabaloo and someone jumps on a table and shoots a pistol in the air. And people are in shock. Everybody stops. Now think about it. Kalev ben Yefoneh has a moment that stands in time. The future of Jewish history is in his hands. You think about the enormous implications of what he's about to do. If Kalev ben Yefoneh can convince the people that they're wrong, that they can enter the land of Israel, then the Jewish people will go directly to the land of Israel. According to Jewish tradition, there'll be no need for a tabernacle, for a Mishkan. There'll never be a Mishkan. Right? They'll just go straight in and build the temple. They'll build a Beit HaMikdash. And according to some traditions, Moshe, before he dies, will come in with them. Because remember, he hasn't hit the rock yet. That comes later. And according to the Zohar, if Moshe builds the temple, it'll last forever. And that would mean, you know, no waiting for King Solomon. No sin of marrying the daughter of Pharaoh. No destruction, no Holocaust, all of that. And even if you don't buy that that's literal, if you accept that it's allegorical, it still has enormous implications. What a different world it would have been if that generation had entered the land of Israel. So we wouldn't have a book of Joshua, because it would be Moshe. So perhaps somehow the Jewish people have a sense that Moshe is not going to enter the land. Yet nonetheless, Kalev stands up and he grabs that moment in history. Now, if you're going to make an argument to the Jewish people that they should listen to God and they should stop mumbling and stop complaining and stop doubting, what would be the most important part of your presentation? What would be the most cogent argument you could offer? Very simple. You would mention the miracles. You would say, what's the matter with you people? Are you out of your minds? We just witnessed the splitting of the sea. We just saw God give 10 plagues to the Egyptians. You're worried what he's going to do to the Canaanites? The entire Egyptian army wiped out in a moment. But Kalev ben Yefoneh doesn't even mention the miracles. There's no mention of that. There's no mention of the fact that God is dropping manna from heaven every day. That there's this miraculous bread they're eating. Nothing. What does Kalev say? Alo na'aleh v'gam nirash. That's his big line. Come on, we can do it. We can go up. This is Kalev's big line? So, how could you miss that? So first of all, who are these princes and how could they doubt that God could take them in? Second of all, where are Moshe and Aaron? Why did they not offer an argument? And third of all, how could Kalev and Yeshua miss the most important point, which is the miracles? So, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, who has an amazing Sefer Likutei Sichot, comments on the Parsha, which is just magnificent stuff, has a perception which is fascinating and completely changes the way you look at the story of the spin of the spies. Says the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the problem here was not that the spies, that the princes, that these leaders didn't believe that God could take them into the land. That's ridiculous. It would be absurd to imagine that such individuals, having witnessed all that they saw, would not believe that Hashem would be able to take them in, that Hashem would be able to enable them to conquer the land. Says the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that's not the issue. The issue wasn't that they didn't think that God could help them conquer the Canaanites. What they were struggling with was, what would conquering the Canaanites do to the Jewish people? You know? Think about it. The Jewish people in the desert were in the greatest yeshiva in history. They were learning from no less than Moshe Rabbeinu. God was everywhere. Miracles surrounded them. They were protected by clouds of glory. They were drinking water from the magic well of Miriam. They received manna from heaven every day. Every time they had a complaint, another miracle comes their way. Unbelievable. And what this did for the Jewish people spiritually was also incredible. So if that's the case, says the Lubavitch Rebbe, perhaps the issue was that the spies couldn't bring themselves to leave this. How could? Oh, I apologize. That's our dog. I apologize. He's into the portion of the week. But if that's the case, how could you leave that? What the spies were saying was, how can we leave yeshiva? You know, Hashem never tells us it's time to go in now. Hashem just said we should be going to the land of Israel. But what's the rush? We're in the Garden of Eden. We're in the desert. We're learning from Moshe. And the spies had an instinctive understanding and maybe even a tradition that the miracles would stop when they entered the land of Israel. They're going to have to start farming for their food. They're going to have to fight. God is not going to conquer the Canaanites for them. Because the desert experience was an experience just as childhood is, where your parents, in this case God, gives you everything. But then you have to grow up, and you have to earn it on your own. The Jewish people are going to enter the land of Israel, and they are going to become who they're meant to be. What will it do to them? What does it do to your spiritual level? To have to conquer, to have to farm, to have to leave the walls of the yeshiva and begin to enter the real world. That's what the spies were struggling with. And by the way, if that's the case, that's why Kalev and Yeshua don't mention the miracles. Because the miracles were exactly the point. If Kalev stands up and says, how could you leave all the miracles, right? How could you not want to enter, look at all the miracles? The spies are saying, that's exactly the point. Of course we believe in all the miracles, we just don't want to leave them behind. Let's stay in this environment. I remember when I was in yeshiva, and I decided to go back into the army to go to officer's course. And I had a chavruta, I had a study partner, and he had a very good point. He said, look, you know, you did your 9 months, you did your year, whatever it was, you're a sergeant. Why do you need to go back? You're finished. You're learning, you're into it, you talk about you want to be a rabbi. If you go to the army, it's going to bring you down. It's going to lower your spiritual level. And I understand this. I mean, I saw this more than once. I remember I had a soldier later when I was an officer whose name was Shai Tzinder. And Shai Tzinder was a religious guy. He came from the kibbutz of the T. But I watched gradually. You know, I wasn't wearing my rabbinic hat then. And I watched gradually as his religious level just started to drop. You know, at the beginning when I first got to the battalion, so I was the only other guy with a kippah on the base. And I used to go in the morning and daven. It was like a little excuse for a synagogue. It was a room you could, you know, fit 5, 6, maybe 10 guys in. Had a 105-millimeter shell box for an aron with no Torah in it and a few dusty books. But I figured if that was a synagogue, I'd go daven there. And I used to sometimes run into him davening. And then gradually I stopped seeing him there. And then on Shabbat afternoons, you know, the Agudala Manachayal, I forget what it's called in English, you know, for the soldiers, this organization, donated a television set. So when we were on the line opposite the Jordanians, which was a very quiet border, so the guys would sit after we finished our work on the tanks, and they would watch TV. So Shabbat afternoon, they would all get together, they would watch, like, I don't know, whatever it was, Wide World of Wrestling or something. So he, after a while, started to go and sit with them, because these are all his buddies, and they're all watching TV. So he wouldn't turn the TV on, he wouldn't turn the light on, had his keep on. And then gradually, you know, when they would go out, so if they would eat at an unkosher restaurant, he would eat too. He wouldn't eat a burger, but he would eat. And gradually it went down and down and down. And then I remember he came to me to talk to me. He wanted to talk to me. So we had a schmooze, and he asked my advice. He said, you know that I'm not really as into it as I was, you know, not so long ago. And to be honest, I don't know if I'm not really keeping kosher anymore. And Shabbat afternoon, I sit with the guys and we watch TV. He said, but I do keep my keep on. You know, I come from a kibbutz of dati. And the guys all make fun of me. They say to me, you know, oshta dati, oshta lo dati. Are you religious or you're not religious? And I feel kind of funny. But on the other hand, if I take my kippah off, so what am I going to do? I'm going to go home. If I go home without my kippah, it's going to break my parents' hearts. Right? They're kibbutznikim. Right? Kibbutz of dati, the religious kibbutz movement. On the other hand, if I go home with my kippah and take it off and then, you know, take it off when I leave, take it, put it back on when I go, I'll feel like a hypocrite. So I don't know what to do. So I said to him, look, I can't tell you what to do. That's a tough question. I can tell you that if you take your kippah off, it's going to be much harder to put it back on. Anyway, he struggled with it and he decided, and I said to him, you know, if you wear a kippah, so that just means you're proud of being Jewish. So where could you think of a more appropriate place to wear a kippah than in the Israeli army? But I said, you know, I can't. It's up to you. I don't know. I mean, I was like 20 years old. I was young. So in the end, he didn't take his kippah off. And the reason I so remember that story was because 3 days later, a Jordanian soldier snuck across the border and ambushed one of the patrols. He was on it, and he was killed. And I remember when I went to the shiva, and I was sitting with his parents, I struggled with whether I should tell them the story. And I decided to tell them the story because they were desperate to know anything about him. And I told them at the end, you know, he decided to keep his kippah on. It meant a lot to him, how you felt about him and whatever. The army brings you down. It does. It either builds you up or it brings you down. So I understand what the Meraglim were saying. I understand that they were struggling with this. But perhaps what the Torah is telling you, it's true. You run that risk when you go out into the world. But the purpose of the learning of Torah is not for it to stay in the Beit Midrash, in the house of study. If your Torah doesn't accompany you, if you can't bring it out with you into the field, then what's the point? Now this raises many issues in contemporary society. And you can only disagree with someone when you first respect where they're coming from. And I have tremendous respect for the boys who sit and learn Torah, even for years and years, because at the end of the day, if we didn't have Torah study, we wouldn't be here today. It wasn't Zionism that kept the Jewish people for the last 2,000 years. But having said that, nonetheless, after 2,000 years, we have the opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah, the Melchemet mitzvah, of going to battle to save and to protect the Jewish people. That's a very significant decision to decide that you're not going to go and join the army because you're sitting and learning Torah. And it's not at all clear that there's any permissibility to do that, if indeed, as the Rambam suggests, it's Melchemet mitzvah, it's a war of obligation. Because these boys are not from Shevet Levi, they're not Leviim, they don't necessarily have that permissibility. Very complicated question. And perhaps the clues to the Torah's perspective on that question, at least according to the Lubavitch Rebbe, are hidden in this week's story. By the way, to his credit, the Lubavitch Rebbe, I mean, I'm not a Lubavitch Chassid, and Zechar Tzadok Livracha, the Lubavitch Rebbe, did pass away, but a tremendous Torah scholar, and on such a level. And he lived up to what he taught. You know, the smicha program in Chabad was very short. There was a 6-month smicha to become a rabbi. And guys would go and sit 2, 3, 4 years maybe in yeshiva, and then he would send them out. And that's why there's shluchim all over the Jewish world. So if there's a chassidus that believes that you can learn, but that learning is only valuable if you take it out into the world and make a difference, it's definitely Chabad. You know, all over the Jewish world. Anywhere you go, you can find the place in Chabad where everyone is made to feel welcome. And I, like I said, I'm not a Chabadnik, but you have to respect what Chabad does. And so that's maybe a little bit of food for thought on this week's parsha.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.